Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 315, recorded September 25th, 2017. Natalia Barina. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you looking to hire a tech professional? With ZipRecruiter, you can post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE. To learn more about fiber optic download speeds on a smartphone, go to snapdragon.com/gigabit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to some of the most amazing people in tech today about the amazing things that they're doing. I'm Megan Maroney. My guest today is a software engineer. She's worked at eBay. She's worked at Microsoft and other places. She founded her own company, her own app, Parable. And also this year, she was named one of the 2017 most powerful female engineers. And she is also a mentor for the Stanford Society of Women Engineers. Welcome, Natalia Barina. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I am so impressed. We met on Twitter because Selena Larson, a mutual friend, a Twitter friend of ours, asked, how's the best way to find a mentor? And I said, I remember I just tweeted back some very unhelpful answer, which was, didn't Sheryl Sandberg say something about that? And you nicely tweeted back, yes, she said, don't ask. and then we had a polite conversation, you and I, on Twitter about this. And now we're Twitter friends. Now we like each other's posts. So I am so glad to have you here. And I'm so glad that you stepped in politely about, because you have so much experience being an engineer and you're being a mentor. And it's always good to talk to people who've been out there. So let's start from where you started, where you came from. You were born in Mostar in the Balkans. Tell us about that.
So I have the distinct honor of being able to say that I was born in a country that no longer exists. I was born in Yugoslavia back when it was still called that. And I spent my early childhood there. For the most part, I actually grew up in Seattle. When I was in Yugoslavia, my childhood was really idyllic. I grew up with a vast support system. So I had my grandparents, aunts, uncles, all sorts of cousins. And it was a really nice place to have my early childhood. For example, I would be able to walk around town all by myself, even as early as the age of 7. And I would always run into somebody I knew. So there was this really nice small town atmosphere. The other really big positive was that for vacation, we would be able to drive to Croatia, only 2 hours away. And many summers, we would drive to Greece with both of my grandmothers in tow. And so it was really nice.
So those of us, those people out there who aren't familiar with their history, tell us why, when and why you left.
So I left in the summer of 1989, and actually the reason that I left with my family is because my mother won a spot in an engineering exchange program. So we all moved, and she started to work at Boeing. And the idea was that we would live in Seattle temporarily for 2 years. My sister and I would get to learn English, would get to learn about a new culture. And then, unfortunately, the war broke out, and we ended up sort of stuck. And of course, everything sort of went south very quickly. The situation in former Yugoslavia deteriorated, and the country plunged into a war. So it was a very difficult time. Most of my family had to leave and were refugees. And we ended up staying in Seattle. And so sort of a dramatic story of my early childhood.
And did you start, you started there without knowing any English at all?
I studied English as a child in fourth and fifth grade, but I didn't know much when I arrived in the U.S. And then I learned very quickly. So my parents pushed me into a regular school program. You had the option of going into English as a second language or just a regular program. And so my parents pushed me into the normal school program. And within 5 months, I could speak English fluently because I had to. I had no choice. And I actually ended up skipping sixth grade as well, which was interesting.
So whenever we talk about female engineers and how it's difficult not having, you know, a majority of engineers being female, so it's hard not to see a model. You had a model in your own home with your mother being an engineer. And in many ways, her job probably saved your lives in some way by coming to Seattle. I mean, what was that like? Did you, I mean, obviously you don't know any different than having a mother as an engineer, but how do you think it influenced you?
Oh, it influenced me very much. She had a huge impact on me, and she was my model. She was somebody I looked up to. As you said, she was the reason we were able to survive and the reason we were able to have all these opportunities where otherwise, who knows what would have happened with us. In fact, she helped my extended family as well. She helped to support them when they were refugees. And so for me, I saw engineering as a great career option from the very beginning, because my mother was so successful. And seeing my parents struggle, I really wanted to do right by them. And we saw that engineering was a clear path to success. So having lost everything in the war, it was very important for us to be able to reestablish ourselves in the United States. And so it became clear that technology was a great pathway towards that. And so from the very beginning, that's what I worked on and that's what I focused on. And I'm really glad it worked out that way. It's been extremely beneficial for me. I'm happy with my decisions to go into engineering early on.
And so when you were young, when you were in school, did you find yourself excelling in math? And were there other girls? Was that ever an issue with you, that idea that, like, oh, girls aren't supposed to be good at math?
Yes. So it was interesting because when I initially arrived in the U.S., I was actually ahead of my peers in math. And it was unusual, to say the least. I was always the geeky girl, the only geeky girl in the math club. And I always was the only girl in all my university classes, in the math club. And then later on at work, in my very first jobs, and even more recently, it's just been a pattern. Trend, but something I'm used to. And, you know, it's difficult. I don't know otherwise. I find the company of women, when it's all women, it's so wonderful, but it doesn't happen very, very much.
And as you're mentoring younger girls, are you finding that that's changed, or is it pretty much the same?
It's very similar. There aren't many changes. I think culturally, women are, girls are not expected to go into engineering, and there's definitely some bias against that. Now, I mentor young undergraduates at Stanford, and all the women that I mentor have already chosen engineering, and so it's sort of a select group. I did work with high schoolers a little bit as well, and there's definitely more of a mix, and so I work on encouraging young women and making sure they start, but then they also continue on that pathway, because as we know, oftentimes women drop out of engineering or technology later on.
Yeah, or I mean, even later on. I mean, I know that this is something I learned from Sheryl Sandberg's book as well, that, you know, I graduated from college in 1995. And, you know, those of us graduating, you know, it went down from there. It was going up. And then there was a moment at which then people in the field, not necessarily undergraduates, but people in the field were leaving. Have you seen that as you've been in the workforce? I know you worked for several big companies and started your own company. Have you seen that? Have you seen colleagues, female colleagues, leave as you've been working?
I've seen women struggle a lot as they move up and become more senior. Of course, you know, there's a component of that that's related to motherhood. But I talk to many women in the industry who are struggling to stay. And, you know, one of the reasons is just naturally, the more you progress in your career, the harder it becomes to move up. And of course, the rank thin anyway. But a lot of the women have increased responsibilities and have to figure out ways to deal with those efficiently. And so I talk to many women who are struggling, but I also have many friends who are doing an amazing job balancing both work and life, and they find solutions. And of course, as Sheryl talks about, one of the things is having an amazing partner, having supportive family, and then sometimes just finding help, outside help as well. But yeah, there's no question, it does get more difficult the more senior you get. There's just fewer jobs at the levels that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. So you told Business Insider, they did a great profile on you, and you said with immigrant parents, you had to either be an engineer or a doctor. That was sort of what everyone assumed. You talked a little bit about that, but did you want to be anything else? Do you feel like you became an engineer because of your interest in math and engineering, or did you dream of being something else and sort of were pushed into it?
Yes, I had other ideas about what I wanted to become. And early on, as a child, I was a voracious reader. I loved to read and I loved to write. And I enjoy learning new languages. And as a teen, I would write whole books full of observations about the world. And I was really into literature. And so naturally, I wanted to be a writer, and it's something that I aspire to. So obviously, I did not go that route, but I appreciate writing, and that's a skill that's become increasingly valuable for me in my career as I become more and more senior. The ability to communicate well, both verbally and in a written form, is extremely important. Actually, I do have some precedent in my family. My grandfather was a published author and a poet and spoke 5 languages. So we do have a little bit of a strain of literature and writing. I definitely decided to go the mathematical route. But been able to combine the two the more I progress.
I think it's so important to combine the two. I mean, I think you're exactly right. You need to communicate no matter what you're doing. Communicating verbally and in writing is important and shouldn't be divided so much, you know, whether you're interested in the humanities or the sciences. So it's great. And you definitely used that in your first app, Parable, which we will talk about. But first, I want to talk about a little bit about your early career. You wrote that it was difficult. You had some struggles, especially interviewing. So I guess that's where those verbal skills come in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Interviewing for me never came naturally. I was very shy, very shy person, very introverted. And I would get extremely nervous when I was interviewing. It also took a lot of work for me to learn how to present myself and how to sort of sell myself and talk about my accomplishments. I have a very hard time with that. And I think it's a little bit of it is definitely cultural as well. But over time, I find that it's a lot of practice. So, of course, the more experience you have, the better you get. And in order to get better, it's really all about being thoughtful, thinking through the scenarios ahead of time, and thinking about how you can tell your story in a way that resounds with people. So it's something I continue to work on, but I definitely struggled with it a lot early on.
Did you get any of those weird questions that we're always hearing about, like, you know,
the yes. round? I went through many interview gauntlets. There were like 9 hours of interviews where it was all coding on the board, and some of the questions were puzzles, but definitely a difficult, harrowing experience. And so you have to spend a lot of time. I mean, at least in my case, I would spend a lot of time preparing. And then you get through the gauntlet and you feel good, but it's never easy. Yeah.
And now in your career, you've also hired a lot of engineers. What's it like to be on the other side of that now?
It's very interesting. When you're looking for a job, you have this perception that the process is highly objective. And what you learn when you're on the other side is that there are so many different reasons why somebody does not get hired, and that it may have nothing to do with the candidate or their skills. So sometimes the timing is off. Sometimes there's simply somebody who's slightly better fit. Things change in organizations very quickly. At the end of the day, it's very difficult to assess somebody within a short period of time. Even if you have 8 people talk to them, it's still difficult to understand how they would react in real world situations. So my advice to anyone looking for a job is, you know, think of it as a fun way to tell your story, to present yourself, but it's definitely not necessarily reflective of your abilities or skills. It's different than working day to day in an office with people.
And I've talked to a few female engineers who are in charge of hiring who say it's still hard to find other female engineers, and whether it's the leaky pipeline or for whatever reason. Do you find that to be true?
Not at all. I have so many friends who are engineers. I know so many women, and I don't think it's difficult to find them at all. I think it just requires a little bit of effort. They do exist, and they're amazing. And if anyone needs to find any, please feel free to contact me. I have plenty of recommendations, and they're absolutely amazing. So I don't think that's the case.
And so when you say it requires a little more effort, like, can you be give me any specifics?
Well, not for me. I know a lot of amazing women. But usually if you find a couple of women you respect or think have a great background, simply go talk to them. They probably have a network of other women that they can refer you to. So that's the best way to go about it.
So when you... were you in charge of hiring people for your app that you developed or at your startup? Or
absolutely.
And so not in the big, not at Microsoft or eBay. You weren't hired. Did you hire people there as well?
I did. I hired people at Microsoft, eBay. I interviewed a lot of people at Salesforce. I've done hundreds of interviews of candidates, both junior and more senior, typically in product, but also engineers as well.
I forgot to mention that you were at Salesforce. Sorry.
No worries.
And so, so you said it's not difficult to find these people to interview. Did you find it difficult at any of the places you worked for to convince other people? Did you feel like there was still a bias as you were in hiring?
There was no clear bias. I definitely believe there is bias, but it's one of these things where it's hard to see. Only occasionally will you see signs of it and red flags that point you to bias. I think definitely with women tend to undersell themselves and tend to seem a little bit more shy than men do in general, from my experience. Not all, but many of them. So that I see, I happen to work in a lot of organizations that had amazing women who were senior. And so in those cases, I did not see that much bias. But there were some organizations I worked in that had an inordinate number of men coming through the interview pipeline and not enough women. And that's definitely an issue and something that I pointed out and worked to remedy and to get more women into the pipeline. Just getting more women into the interviewing pipeline is step one. And then step two is getting them through that pipeline and getting them hired. So there are challenges in every step of the process, definitely.
And it's true. Yeah, you're right. All these big places you've worked at, eBay, Salesforce, both have women at the helm. And I mean, I worked for Microsoft for several years, and I found it to be a very female friendly, very family friendly. And that sometimes happens. I mean, when you've had, it's hard to get that big as those three companies are, without having, an overwhelm, it's hard to get that big when you have the bias that a company like, say, Uber has. You know, we've seen that. You know, it's you can get to a certain size and then things go terribly wrong. So did you choose those companies because of that?
It wasn't the only reason, but it definitely helped. I like to work in environments that are welcoming and positive. And it was definitely part of the reason why I joined, but definitely it was not the only reason.
And let's talk a little bit about mentorship. Did you have female mentors that helped you get to be where you are?
I did. I had a couple. So one of them was my original mentor is my mother, of course. I was very lucky and sort of won the lottery there. My grandmother also had an incredible impact on me growing up. She came from a very simple peasant background, but she stressed education for her daughters and for me. She was really big on education. And for her, it was a pathway towards independence, which was very important because she grew up in a time and a place where, there were lots of wars, there was a lot of instability. And so this was one way to ensure that you did well in life. At Microsoft, I was really fortunate to work with Ava Dominovska, who is currently a director of machine learning at Google. And she was my early mentor when I was at Microsoft. She's an incredible woman who is both an amazing engineer and an incredible product person. And more informally, I had one of my earlier bosses whose name is Sanaz Ahari Lemelson. And she sort of mentored me and taught me how to be a great product person. She's also currently at Google. That was more informal, but it definitely helped a lot to have those women there.
And so were any of these part of, you said they were formal mentoring relationships, but were they part, was it a situation where you asked, someone, can you be my mentor, or was it based in the place that you worked?
Absolutely. I met Ava and I asked her. The way that I identified her is I had an enormous amount of respect for her and her accomplishments in her career. I met her. We had really great chemistry, and I think we, I just imagined that we probably had some similar challenges. And so after meeting her and getting to know her a little bit, I just said, hey, could you help me? Could you mentor me? And can we make it a regular monthly thing where we just meet for coffee and talk through some of the problems that I have and how to go about solving them? And that's pretty much how it happened.
So you would recommend that if someone, what would you recommend if someone was looking for a mentor? Do you have any tips besides asking?
Well, before asking, it's important to get to know the person and establish a rapport, because you don't want to ask somebody in a way that will impose them. And you want to do it in a way that'll give them a way out if they are really busy. Many people are. So again, I think it's really important to know why you're asking, to know who the person is and why they're a good fit, and work on establishing a rapport, and then approach them in a way that still gives them an out.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about mentorship, and I know you don't enjoy talking about yourself, but I'm going to ask you to do that some more. And I want to talk about the many products that you've worked on, and also artificial intelligence, which is your focus now. But first, I want to take a second to thank our sponsor. The sponsor of Triangulation is ZipRecruiter, which makes perfect sense because we've been talking about hiring and how easy it is to hire the right candidates for some people like Natalia, but she has a big network. What if you don't have a big network? What if you want to find diverse people for your company and you don't know a lot of people? So you can use ZipRecruiter. That is one way to reach out and go beyond your inner circle to find people that would be right for your business. It's challenging, but you can do it. If you're in charge of hiring, you have the most important job in a company. The people you hire can make or break your business. ZipRecruiter will connect you to the most qualified candidates for any job, including highly sought after tech professionals. With just one click, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites. Their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. 80% of employers who posted a job on ZipRecruiter got a qualified candidate through the site within one day. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Connect with a wide variety of professionals, including IT experts, and take your company to the next level today. More than 300 million applicants have been delivered. And if you're currently searching for a job, ZipRecruiter will help you find your future job in any industry, including technology, government, business, finance, and more. Upload your resume and then apply with just one click. Be sure to check out the ZipRecruiter blog for recruiting tips and some really helpful career advice. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. That's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Triangulation. So did you have any male mentors, or do you have any experience where you've witnessed young male female mentors? Is that, I mean, that's another, I keep bringing up Sheryl Sandberg's book, but that's something that she talks about, how it's difficult. Part of the reason women don't have mentors is because it's uncomfortable. You wouldn't, it might be uncomfortable to like meet in a bar late at night, that sort of situation. Do you have any experience with that?
Meeting people late in bars at night.
Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you for not just answering the question.
I avoid that. My solution is just totally avoid that particular.
So I guess you've talked about how that you have sort of an idyllic situation with all these female mentors. Have you had also male mentors? And
absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. If you're a woman who works in technology, you should absolutely work on having a male mentor and finding, again, it's hard for everyone because people you want as your mentors are extremely busy, accomplished, and less successful, accessible. But for me, those people were Hugh Williams, who was most recently a VP of Google Maps, and he's a data and search expert. And actually, we worked together way back at Microsoft and then at eBay as well. And similar to other examples, I just happened to have a great rapport with him and approached him and said, hey, do you mind working with me occasionally, meeting whenever you have time? I would love to get your perspective on these particular issues as I progress in my career. The other person who is amazing to work with is Steven Sinofsky. And Steven is a former president of Windows Division at Microsoft. And he's been extremely helpful and supportive and an amazing person all around.
And do you have, I know you worked, you said you worked with women at Stanford. Have you ever had a male mentee?
Interesting question. I have not.
Has anyone ever asked?
Nobody has ever asked. I've given advice informally that was one-off, but I've never had a male mentee, no.
And so, obviously, you would welcome that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
So, if anyone's listening out here, not necessarily Natalia, because you don't know her, but if you have a woman in your office who you respect, and yeah, go ahead and ask. That's good. So, let's move on to your products. Let's talk about Parable. That was how I originally first heard of you. Talk a little bit about what Parable is first, and then we'll talk about how you started it.
So Parable is a creative photo network, and the way it works, it's somewhat similar to Instagram in that it's a network and a tool both at the same time. And so the idea was with Parable, you can customize your posts. You can, as you can see here, you have some preset backgrounds, you have filters, you can play around with fonts and be really creative. There's also a community behind Parable, so you can follow people, you can comment on their posts, you can connect with them and share in this beautiful way. And so it was absolutely an adventure building it, and I love the product and talk about it for days.
What inspired you to create it?
We noticed that photos with text on them were going viral, and they usually did not look very nice. So we wanted to build a tool that let users create this beautiful, gorgeous experience. And our hypothesis was that digital content was increasingly being customized and altered in different ways, and we were right on with that trend.
And so this was after you created the app, after you created your startup, or how did you, was it a side hustle while you were working somewhere else? When did you start working on it?
I started working on building my own company after leaving eBay. And this was the second idea that I worked on. The first one was not was very difficult and sort of failed.
What made you decide to go out on your own and start your own company?
When I came to the Silicon Valley, that was always my goal. I always wanted to try and build my own company and be creative and have full control and ownership what I was building. I'd done pretty well in corporate environments, but of course, there's always some limitations working. I mean, the great thing is you get a lot of support and resources working in big corporations, but you don't have full control of the creative process. And so I moved to Silicon Valley to join eBay, but I knew that I moved and I would eventually want to try building my own company.
So was that when you first left Seattle? Had you lived in Seattle ever since you had left the Balkans until you went to...
Yeah. Wow. Yes, I... grew up, I went to school there, and I worked there until about 2010. I moved to Silicon Valley to join eBay 2010 and have been here ever since.
And so what's the difference between the tech scene in Seattle versus the scene in Silicon Valley?
It's much smaller. And of course, it's dominated by Amazon and Microsoft. And there's great attempts at building a startup community, but it just has not reached the sort of scale that's available here in Silicon Valley. The other really big difference is that the level of support is and financial resources that you have here in the Valley is not quite comparable yet. But Seattle has grown tremendously, and it continues to grow. I love being in the Valley. I was really tired of the weather. I love Seattle, but 300 days out of the year, it's raining.
And so was there ever any pressure for you to join Boeing, like mother-like-daughter situation?
No, actually, my mother after left Boeing and joined Microsoft.
Oh.
And we did not cross paths there. But I knew that I wanted to work on software and not with aeronautical industry.
Okay, so you started your startup, and that was Orange Peel. Is that what it was called?
Orange. Yeah. So Orange Peel Labs was the one umbrella name, and then we had multiple products, and Parable was one of them.
And so the other was that where you started Flockish or ShopSnap, or was this? Did you have another one that didn't work out that we haven't heard of?
Flockish was a side project while I was at eBay, and it was also sort of a social network, mobile social platform to discover gatherings around you. So it was an early version of a very ephemeral experience, not like Snapchat. It was not photo-based, but the idea was more around events. So being able to join events that were impromptu and gatherings. And it was a side project that was bought by StubHub, actually.
Oh, well, that's amazing. So all that happened while you were still at eBay?
Yes.
And so was that complicated to work on a side project, start a company, sell a company, all while working for another company?
Well, I did have a co-founder, so he did a lot of the work. I definitely helped and contributed, but I had some help there. So it was not hard.
And was the goal to sell it, or did you at that point want to go out on your own?
The goal was to build something that people found useful for Flockish. Eventually, my goal was to go out on my own and try building something. And that's when I started ShopSnap.
So tell us about ShopSnap.
So ShopSnap was an attempt to unify offline and online commerce via a marketplace. So after I worked at eBay, I was just completely enamored with marketplaces. However, the challenge of so the idea was, to give you more context, you would be able to go to a site and see all the local inventory in stores around you. And it would be a marketplace that would have both the consumers as well as merchants. You see Amazon going into offline now. But for a small startup that has very few resources, this was a really difficult idea to execute on. So specifically, you have to build liquidity both on the demand and the supply side, which is a notoriously difficult problem. Two, there is inconsistency and lack of availability of data from merchants. And ultimately, we just decided that this particular problem was too big for us and too early. So at that point, we stopped and we started experimenting with Parable.
And so what year was that? Was that 2014, 2015?
That's right. That was 2014.
And so do you look at, you said too early, like do you see, is that a familiar experience for you and other entrepreneurs? Do you think that you have this great idea and then someone, it's just a couple years too early?
Absolutely. So this is exactly, you know, now we talk about artificial intelligence, but 10 years ago, it was too early to build artificial intelligence products because we simply did not have the amount of data available that we have today. The second thing with artificial intelligence products is there was simply the amount of compute power was not there at the time. So that's a perfect example where now is the right time to build artificial intelligence products. But 10 years ago, it was much harder and it's just too difficult to get it off the ground. People did it and they made some fantastic advancements that we're using today. But in general, I would say it's really a lot of it is about the right timing and having the right tools available to make a company successful. A lot of times it's too early and it's not something you can control, even if you can build an amazing product and team.
Okay, so you went from ShopSnap, then you built Parable. What did you learn from ShopSnap that helped you build Parable?
How important sales and marketing are. As a geeky technologist, we focused on a technology and product. But my biggest lesson was that sales and marketing are integral part of company building and skills that are really important to have or at least hire for.
And so did you hire for those? Did you hire out or did you teach yourself how to do the marketing or both?
Well, that part of the reason why I went to Salesforce was to learn all about sales.
So that with Parable, I know I remember hearing about it. I can't remember where, but some part, it was when I was working on a show that where we talked about apps. So obviously we're doing something right, getting it into my ear. And I know maybe I heard about it on Product Hunt because I know that you've written about how important Product Hunt is to getting your app out there. Were those the kinds of things that you did? Because Parable was before Salesforce, or was that at the same time?
Right. It was before Salesforce. And you're right. We were featured on Product Hunt, which is maybe how you heard about it.
And so, okay, so that was my next question. You went from, you finally had your own thing, the Orange Peel Labs, and then you went back to the big corporation, back to Salesforce. Was it just to learn more about selling?
I thought about it, about that decision in three ways. One was that I had the opportunity to work on a social product at Salesforce. So I worked on Community Cloud, and there were that definitely parallels with my experience building Parable there. So it was somewhat similar. Two, I got to work on artificial intelligence at Salesforce, and I was really interested in that particular area. I had worked on it before, both at eBay and at Microsoft, when I built search products, and I just thought these were awesome problems to tackle, and problems that enterprise has in the enterprise arena. There's enormous opportunity there. And then the third reason why I joined was I wanted to learn how to build products that make money right out the gate. So prior to Salesforce, all my experience was building consumer. And so here was something new that I was curious about. And so for those three reasons, I decided to join Salesforce.
Okay, well, you've talked about AI a little bit, but that is your passion. That's your that's what you're thinking about and working on now. And I want to talk about that. But first, I want to take a second to thank Qualcomm for sponsoring this show. The Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE will get your apps downloaded faster. You get through all the network congestion that you have in airports and other busy places. Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE has additional lanes for your data to flow through. They can squeeze more speed from each LTE connection. And that's what we're all looking for in life, more speed from our phones. Snapdragon Gigabit LTE is like driving on a much wider, much faster data highway. Average LTE download speeds are up to 7 times faster than typical home Wi-Fi. It can turbocharge all of your connected apps, stream 360-degree videos in YouTube VR, 4K resolution with minimal buffering. Minimal buffering, that's what we all want. And then you can also access all your files in the cloud nearly as fast as you would if they were stored on your phone. Download hours of music or movies in just seconds. Load Android Instant apps almost instantly. Make the most of your unlimited data plan. To learn more about faster network connections in crowded places, visit snapdragon.com/gigabit. That's snapdragon.com/gigabit. And we thank Qualcomm Snapdragon Gigabit LTE for their support. AI. So what is it, Natalia, that first, when did you first get interested in artificial intelligence?
Well, artificial intelligence is 90% math. So I have a lot of relevant background, having studied math at the university. I first learned on artificial intelligence problems back in 2008 when I was at Microsoft helping to build Bing Search. Worked on search at eBay as well. So very similar problems that give me some of the fundamentals to tackle problems in the field.
And so now everyone's throwing around AI all the time, whether it is actually AI that they're talking about or not. What do you think the fascination with AI now? Is it, as you spoke of before, that it's just more possible to do things with AI? Why is it becoming such a big buzzword right now?
Yeah, so the reason why it's AI has become so huge now is because some of the basic prerequisites for building effective AI are finally at a time and place where they are satisfied. So those three things are having data. In order to build AI, you need to have lots of data that power the experience and the product that you can learn from, create these virtual loops where the machine is constantly learning. The second is we finally have enough compute power to tackle these problems. You need to be able to perform calculations on a large amount of data and do it as quickly as possible. And then three, we've had amazing breakthroughs in the modeling piece, so the data science aspect of it. With deep learning is the biggest one. But those three preconditions have finally been met. And so now we can actually build artificial intelligence products. And of course, the whole idea, the sci-fi idea, the trope of machines taking over is compelling. It's a great story, although we're very far from that.
So you're not in the Elon Musk camp. You're
absolutely not.
Why do you say that? I mean, there's been a lot of arguments that, you know, well, AI is just not smart enough to take over. Is that what it is? Or is it just some fundamental difference in the way it works versus the way human brains work?
We're still so early on. Really, you know, just to get some of the basics up and running takes a lot of effort and time. And it's simply not that advanced at this point. There is promise. Sometimes far into the future, you know, who knows, it could go there. But today, it's still a lot of grunt work just to make things work.
And so I know a lot of people throw around the term AI and neural networks as if they're the same thing. Can you really tell us what the difference between a neural network and AI is?
So AI is it's really a marketing term for a number of different technologies. You know, you have neural networks, you have machine learning is really fundamental of artificial intelligence. And there's deep learning where you have layers and layers. And neural network is taking some of the ideas around how the brain works and trying to apply them to artificial intelligence problems. But really, AI is the marketing term. When we talk about AI, most of the time we talk about machine learning, which is simply
having an algorithm that learns gets better over time by feeding it an enormous amount of data.
So that really is what you've been working on. I mean, if you were working on Bing, then, I mean, that's the same part of the same thing, right?
Yeah. So one of the biggest applications of machine learning is ranking of search results. And both Bing and Google, that's how they serve search results, in fact. And the typical use case.
Yeah. And so you have would you describe discrete AI as your side project or your hobby? Yeah. What would you call discrete AI?
So discrete AI is simply a way for me to explore some ideas in the field. And so currently we're playing around with voice applications where we leverage Amazon Alexa and Google Home. We have some enterprise scheduling solutions that we're working on at the moment. And then we plan on looking at recommendations, which is a problem I worked on a great deal at Salesforce. I ran one of the teams that serves over 100 million recommendations per week in the Salesforce platform. And then also we're looking at some AR and VR problems as well. So very exploratory at the moment.
And so was your experience at Salesforce, was that the first experience you had really working with the enterprise, or were you doing that also?
Yeah.
What do you like better? Do you like working on enterprise solutions or consumer?
You know, that's a difficult, to be honest with you, for me, it's all about the people you work with. And obviously, the more people you can reach, the better it is. Whether it's consumer or enterprise, I'm pretty agnostic. I measure it in impact. So, and that's how many people use your product.
And so is it more, what are some challenges of working in the enterprise versus working for the products, consumer products?
Well, if you're working on AI, the data that you need is more difficult to get than if you have consumer products. So in enterprise, typically data is very siloed. And so you have to be very creative about how you go about obtaining that data. If you run a consumer product, that data is readily available to you, and you're the owner of it. In enterprise, trust is a really big deal. So you have to work very hard to make sure you do right by your customers. I'm not saying you don't in consumer, but it's really a vital part of your business. So by trust, I mean making sure you have full availability of your services at all times. And, of course, security is a really big deal when you're building for enterprise.
And so do you feel, I mean, how often are you addressed in what you're working and thinking about now? How often do you consider the kind of sort of Terminator problem?
Never.
Now, you have to consider it a little bit, right? I mean, otherwise, I don't know.
No,
what.
I'm more worried about making sure that the products we built don't have built-in bias, which is a very difficult problem. Things like making sure that it represents the entire population, that it properly accounts for male and female. And the issue with building AI is it feeds on data that comes from humans, and humans have inbuilt biases, and then those biases make it into your product. So I think about how do we ensure that does not happen? How do we make sure that we build products that are equitable for everyone? The Terminator scenario is just so far out. I don't worry about that.
It's so interesting that you bring up that, because it really is so often we're worried about the wrong thing. Like, we're worried about some AI locking us out of our house, or, you know, driving our car without us. But really, it might be better, that we really worry about what we see every day, where the ads on Facebook can be controlled, or, you know, there's things that get deleted off Twitter because of an algorithm. So how do you do that? I mean, that must be a really challenging part of building an algorithm. I mean, I keep saying, like, well, anyone should build an algorithm, just assuming that all people are horrible and work from there. Is that what you have to do?
It's not so much about the algorithm. It's about the quality of the data that feeds the algorithm. So the algorithm will adjust based on the data. And again, it's really about making sure that the data is representative and that you think about these use cases. The problem in industry oftentimes is you're so pressed for time to get the product out, and you have to meet deadlines. You have to be very cognizant of use cases that could be problematic. And by definition, building AI machine learning products, you will have errors. That's just part of the deal. They're called false positives, and the times that your machine learning shows results will just be wrong. It's really about machine learning, AI products are really about being able to solve problems at scale. But it's very well understood in the community that there will be some number of times where it gives you the number that or gives you results that are suboptimal. So it's all about controlling those suboptimal results and making sure you minimize the embarrassing output as much as possible.
Minimize the embarrassing output. I like that. I want to talk a little bit more about this, because this is one of the things that's just been fascinating me in the news lately. But I just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor of Triangulation, Rocket Mortgage. If you've ever purchased a mortgage, you know buying a house, it's probably the most expensive thing that you're going to buy. It causes a lot of anxiety and stress. You just want the perfect place for you, but you want to be able to afford it too, because no one wants to be in debt. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans will help you find the right loan that is right just for you and all of the specific things about you and your situation. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It gives you the confidence you need, whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th. Rocket Mortgage can perform thousands of calculations in seconds based on your income, your assets, and credit. Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's right just for you. Just right. Not too big, not too small, not too soft, not too hard. Your mama bear mortgage. That's what you need. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently with Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you want to get started, very simple. Go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Don't forget to add the triangulation. That's the way they know that we sent you to them. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. So AI for the enterprise. You're at Discrete AI. You are working on using Alexa, the Amazon Echo, and the Google Home in the enterprise. Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on, or is it all secret?
It's still very early on. We're just experimenting with those tools and looking for the right, really, the places where we can make the most impact. So,
do you use those devices at your home?
I do. I have both, and I test them all the time, and I use them for cooking and weather, et cetera.
Yeah, my house is blanketed with Echo Dots and Amazon Echoes, and I also have the Echo Show. I use it a lot. So I'm hoping that it won't turn on me in a Terminator situation, but now I trust you that it won't. So the biases in algorithms, is that something that, I mean, for those of us who follow the tech news, it seems to be something that just became a problem in the last few years. But is it something that you've been thinking about in your entire career?
Yeah, it's very important to think about that. And again, to make sure that you have products that are can meet the needs of all customers, regardless of where they are and who they are. It's just part of being a good product manager, really. Knowing, understanding your customers and making sure that you're the voice of those customers when you need to build a product.
And how do you think your background has influenced you in thinking about this? Obviously, I mean, you have a very different background than a lot of people in Silicon Valley. Can you talk a little bit about how that might have affected your outlook?
Yeah, I can give you an example. So my background is I think about international a lot, of course, given that I was not born in the United States. Actually, funny side story, I lived and worked in France for a year. And the reason for that is that my mother thought I was too nerdy after I finished university. So she sent me to France.
That's where you de-nerdify in France, if people are worried about that?
De-nerdify, yes. I learned to cook and I drank a lot of wine.
And you came home still loving math. It didn't work.
No, I mean, it de-nerdified me, but it kept the good, good aspects of being a nerd. I'm very proud of it. So I have a very international outlook when I build products. And when we built Parable, this was one of our key preoccupations. And because we thought about building a product that would satisfy international markets, it actually worked to our advantage. It went really big in China for a while. And any user, regardless of where they come from, can use Parable. It relies very little on language. So it's built in a way that it's highly intuitive, regardless of where you come from. And it was one of our key strengths. And so I think about the international aspect of building products, obviously, because I'm a woman, I make sure that the female perspective is always represented as well.
And so Parable was bought by Samsung, is that correct?
That's right.
But it's still out there. Do you have any involvement anymore with it?
I do not, no.
So what is the biggest advice that you give to people that you're mentoring, whether it's someone starting out thinking about going to college or thinking about breaking away from a corporation and becoming an entrepreneur? Talk a little bit about what advice you have for people.
So I believe in being entrepreneurial, regardless of where you work or what stage of your life you're at. And what do I mean by that? I mean, think about being creative, think about doing things that are different, putting something out there, building or writing, putting those things out there. I think, and nobody is good when they start. I tell people this, nobody is born knowing math or being a great technologist. It takes hours of time to get to a point where the work that you put out there, you actually feel is good. So I encourage people to be very entrepreneurial. The other really big piece of advice I have for all my mentees is find the right people. Find the people that you respect who are highly accomplished and do everything you can to work with them and for them. And things will sort of take care of themselves when you're surrounded by the right people.
I got one last question that I like to ask everybody. Do you have any, what would you say to the Natalia who was coming to the United States knowing no English? If you could go back and tell her, give her some advice, what would you say to her?
The number one thing I would say is that grades are not as important as you think. I tended to be a perfectionist when it came to academics and schoolwork. And I spent a lot of time agonizing and worrying about that. I would say that's important. It's important to study and get an education, but perfect grades should not be the goal.
That is great advice for someone who's worked for Microsoft and eBay and Salesforce and started your own company and sold apps to Samsung and to StubHub. That is really good advice because I think kids do get really stressed and that is not healthy. And you have another project. You have done so much that you have the ability to take some time to think about what your next project is, and you have it, but we don't know what it is. But I am really excited to, when you can tell the world what it is. I'm really excited to hear about what you're going to do next. I know it'll be amazing and thoughtful. Natalia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
Thank you. Natalia Barina can be found at Nail, N-A-L-E, on Twitter. And check there for her personal news that she will announce at some point. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take care. Pleasure. Thank you. And thank you for watching Triangulation. Thank you for watching or listening or both if you did that. Triangulation records every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific time. And the show is hosted by myself and Leo Laporte and Jason Howell and Padre Father Robert Balliser. And it's also hosted by you. You guys are in the chat room asking questions, giving us ideas, and we love that you're there. Please subscribe to the show, twit.tv/triangulation, even if you watch live. Subscribe so that we know who's out there listening and watching. And if you have suggestions for people to interview for the show, email me at Megan@twit.tv and tune in next week to Triangulation.